you know, ourselves in other people's shoes, and we say, well, you know, how do I want to be treated? Then it's easier for us to recognize the true categories of right and wrong, because we know what it's like to be wrong. And so we all recognize actions as evil when we are wrong, even the moral relativist. Now, in Romans 2, 14 and 15, Paul, in that passage, tells us the reason why, you know, our moral experience needs an explanation as much as, you know, if you're trying to explain the existence of rocks, okay, I think the existence of moral laws cry out for explanation, an explanation as much as the existence of rocks and trees. I mean, there's no such thing as human experience without moral categories. And the reason for this, Paul points to in Romans 2, 14 and 15, for when Gentiles who do not have the law, by nature do the things contained in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. He's saying, even if you don't have God's laws written on tablets of stone, even if you don't have God's laws written in the Bible, you still have God's laws written upon your hearts. And so each one of us has a moral conscience. Now, we may, quench the voice of that conscience, but the fact of the matter is, deep down inside, each and every one of us knows that there is such a thing as right and there is such a thing as wrong. You skip on down to point five. Point five is actually an argument for God's existence from the absolute moral law. But only the last few points, though, really turn it into an argument for God's existence. The first few points just refute moral relativism. So just look at this. The first point there is the moral law doesn't originate with the individual, because then we could not call the actions of another individual wrong. In other words, if each individual decides what is right for himself or herself, and there's no higher standard, then we have no way to call the actions of Hitler wrong. But even moral relativists want to call the actions of Hitler wrong. So we've got to look for a higher standard in the individual. So some moral relativists might say, okay, well, maybe it's a society. Maybe a group of individuals get together, say, hey, we've got to live together in peace. Let's come up with our own laws and establish our own society. Well, but the moral law doesn't originate with each society, for then one society could not call the actions of another society wrong. In other words, America and the Allies would not be able to call the actions of Nazi Germany wrong. But most moral relativists would admit that the actions of Nazi Germany as a society was wrong. So many more relativists would say, well, maybe it comes from a world consensus. Problem there is, number one, it's pretty hard to really get a world consensus. Not like we all have these little buttons that we push, you know, and take votes all the time. But in the past, it does seem to be that the world consensus was that the world was flat, that the sun revolved around the earth and not the other way around, that the woman was property of the man and had no rights, that slavery was perfectly okay, there wasn't anything wrong with it. So if the world consensus was wrong before, what makes us think that it's infallible now? And the fact that people today can condemn the world consensus of the past as wrong. Say, well, it was wrong in the past when a woman was considered property of the man. Okay? the fact that we can do that, we're acting as if we're implying that there's a moral standard that is above the world consensus and that it doesn't change with time. Okay? So you know, we need more than to quantitatively just add people together and come up with a society or add more and more people until you get a world consensus. We need a moral law qualitatively above man. Okay? And then if we condemn the actions of the past, and especially to condemn the actions of the past, we need an eternal and unchanging moral law that doesn't change with time. And if we want to condemn the world consensus of the past, not only is it an eternal and unchanging standard, but it is an eternal and unchanging standard that stands above even the world consensus. And so basically, we need a moral, our moral actions imply the existence, and the moral laws, by the way, they're not descriptive like the natural laws, they're not descriptive of the way things are. You know, when we say murder is wrong, we're saying, we're not just saying murder happened, it's not just descriptive, it is prescriptive. It is saying people ought not to murder others. People should not murder others. So it's prescriptive. And just as if you try to get a prescription drug, if you don't have the signature of the prescriber, the doctor, they're not going to give it to you. Same with moral laws. They're prescriptive. Moral laws must have a moral law prescriber, a moral law giver. So the moral law is qualitatively above all men, all societies, and any world consensus, and it doesn't change with time. It's not descriptive of the way things are, but it's prescriptive of the way things ought to be. And therefore, it needs a moral lawgiver qualitatively above all men. Okay? And since the moral laws are eternal and unchanging, the moral lawgiver must be eternal and unchanging as well. And basically, this is the reason why absolute moral laws and God go hand in hand. So that if you at first reject the existence of God and you're a consistent thinker, you're then going to have to reject absolute moral laws and become a moral relativist. But if you want to do your own thing and you reject moral absolutes first, and you're a consistent thinker, eventually you're going to reject God as well. But it's kind of a package deal. Only very inconsistent atheists hold to some type of moral absolutes, and only very inconsistent moral relativists still believe in the existence of God. But, you know, a clear thinking and consistent thinker is going to have to acknowledge that it's a package deal. No God, no moral values. No moral values, no God. And so they go hand in hand. Now, if you look on page 35, what I want to do now is start looking at different worldviews, and the final worldview we're going to be looking at is theism, the belief in a personal God, and then we're going to argue for that, spend some time arguing for God's existence. But atheism, we already talked about the failure of atheism, the belief that there is no God. We showed that the arguments are invalid. They either don't prove what they're trying to prove, i.e. the non-existence of God, or some of their arguments are actually self-refuting. Okay? But basically, there's no explanation for the existence of the universe, for personality, or morality if there is no God. You know, even the existence of truth, the existence of human reason, that human reason really can find truth. You know, if atheism is true, then the statement there is no God is a truth. But if there's no God, atheists have never been able to explain how the statement there is no God could be a truth, because it's not a material thing. And how can invisible truths exist when the atheist, in his attempt to refute God's existence, he ends up arguing out of existence all invisible things? But then if atheism is true, that statement, there is no God, is an invisible thing that exists. It's an invisible truth that exists. And so it's excess baggage for an atheistic worldview. Invisible things don't really fit in a universe without God. Now, if God exists, since he's an invisible God who decided to create a visible universe, it only makes sense that, okay, well, some of the things that exist are invisible as well, like mathematical truths and logical truths and things like love. You know, how much does love weigh? Can you throw it? What color is it? What does the thought look like? You know, can it be measured? Can it be weighed? You know, so there are realities, more moral laws. There are real things that really exist, but that don't take up any space. They're not made of any material, any physical material. So it just doesn't. Atheism is a reductionist view. It tries to explain everything by reducing everything to one element. And almost every reductionist view that you can come up with, it just, you know, you end up by reducing everything to one element, you end up oversimplifying it and not really explaining all the phenomenon in question. But whatever the case, the final death to atheism comes from the fact that the theistic arguments are successful in disproving atheism, and so we'll get to that probably next week. Pantheism is the belief that God is the universe, whereas Christianity teaches that God created the universe. Pantheism teaches that God is the universe. Okay. Usually, the pantheist will argue that God, as the universe, is impersonal, is an impersonal force, rather than a personal God. Like, whereas in Christianity, God loves us, for God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son. Pantheism, God is an impersonal it. He's not a he. God is an it. That's why in Star Wars, it says the Force be with you, not God be with you. And Lucas, the guy who produced it, stated he was trying to evangelize the West with Eastern thought, with Hindu thought, through the movie. And that's why the Force has a dark side and a light side. But he got the Force be with you from the Lord be with you. So the God of pantheism is more like electricity, an impersonal force, than he is like the God of the Bible, a God that is a moral being that commands us not to do certain things and to do other things, that a God that loves us and can have a personal relationship with us. But usually the physical world, since God is one being, and this one being is the universe, but in the physical world we see many different things. Consistent pantheists will argue that the physical world is an illusion. Okay? And some of the problems with pantheism, it fails to explain the existence of evil and the finite self. Pantheism is saying, it's arguing that evil is just an illusion. Well, it's not. It's pretty obvious. I mean, if there's some self-evident truths, if there's a self-evident truth, one of them is that when somebody just walks up to you and punches you in the nose, that is just wrong. And just to say evil is an allusion to a survivor of the Holocaust who lost relatives in the Holocaust, to me, is despicable. So any worldview that can't explain evil and then doesn't offer a solution to evil should be rejected. So basically what I'm getting at, except for Christian theism, all other worldviews lose just on the evil battle alone. Because only all the theistic faiths all explain what evil is, but then through Christ's substitutionary death, substitutionary sacrifice, that alone is the... the covering of evil, yeah, the defeat of evil. Pantheism also fails to explain the finite self. In other words, one way of looking at it is this. Every pantheist I've ever talked to or read believes in reincarnation. That when you die, your soul leaves your body and then reanimates another body, and another body comes into existence. But the fact of the matter is, though, consistent pantheism denies the existence of individual souls and the physical world. So for pantheism to be true, reincarnation has to be true. But for reincarnation to be true, you need individual souls and physical bodies. But if pantheism is true, there's no such thing as individual souls. We're all one soul, and you need individual bodies, physical bodies. So yeah, it's contradictory to the core.
Does pantheism require reincarnation, though?
I
would think that reincarnation requires pantheism, but not necessarily the other way around.
It's really weird too, because I would say yeah, it doesn't require it, but I've yet to see an example of a pantheist who didn't hold to it. Spinoza may be an exception, but the problem with Spinoza is nobody knows what he was, because there's even elements that his pantheism, God is being, but God is the only being. In Spinoza's view, it seems that God is even beyond being. So...
Well, wouldn't, like, Shintoism be considered pantheistic?
Now you're talking the Japanese religion there. It's a very complex religion, and it'd be real tough to say what is dogmatic Shinto and what is not, because a lot of it deals with ancestor worship, which led to emperor worship. A lot of it deals with the kind of the folk religion of Japan, where Their people came from an island, and they were created by God, and all other humans were not created by God. So, I have to look further into it to really see, you know, how far. But it seems that there's polytheistic beliefs there, many gods, but almost every polytheistic religion traced to its roots has pantheistic roots. So I'd have to look for further into it.
And that. Different branches of even Shintoism itself.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. But
I was referring to one that I had learned a little more about than the other, which was the one that basically just worships nature as a general, universe.
And
I don't recall any reincarnation.
Yeah, and is this a person that you knew?
No,
or, just that what you read?
Study in class that I took one.
Yeah, I'll look into it. And what makes things more complex now is the fact that American Westerners are embracing, you know, via the New Age movement, Eastern religions. And when that happens, they don't always accept the whole thing. so they accept it in bits and pieces. But the crazy thing about and differences like that, but most Americans don't like the idea of humans evolving into animals and plants, so just into other humans. But one of the interesting things about the Shinto faith is that it sounds like you're reading something, you know, 200 BC, and this was something the Japanese believed going into, you know, World War II, which explains the kamikaze pilots. And much like Muslims in a holy war, a jihad, you know, suicide bombers, involving suicide bombings, thinking they're going to die and be ushered into paradise. So, but whatever the case, that's one of the problems. Another problem is the pantheist, when a pantheist is trying to convince you that pantheism is true, okay? At its core, what you have is one mind trying to convince another mind that only one mind exists. Okay, so again, you can see it contradictory at its core, because if only one mind exists, why does this one mind have to convince your mind that only one mind exists?
Even within your own mind, you can have contradictory thoughts and be not sure what you truly believe. I mean, I would think that eventually you come to a certain...
Yeah, but even there, that goes beyond... contradictory thoughts within the one mind, there's really no place to fit, because pantheism at the end, it's monistic at its core. Monism says all reality is one. Pantheism says all reality is one, and we worship that one reality. It's God. You could be a monist without being a pantheist, but all pantheists are monists. But not all monists are pantheists. Some monists say all reality is one, but who cares? And other monists say all reality is one, and it's God. But the idea of like contradictory thoughts ultimately, even the contradictory thoughts ultimately would be part of the illusion. Because ultimately there's no duality at all. Ultimately everything is one. So there's not even, not only not separate minds, but not even separate thoughts. So,
but then wouldn't the disagreement between those two people be part of the illusion too?
Yeah, you know but all I'm getting at though is the only consistent way to proclaim the belief that only one mind exists is, you know, walk into your closet, close the door, shut the light, and scream out, "Only one mind exists! Only one mind exists! Only one mind exists!" But once you try to communicate that thought to another person, you're furthering the illusion to try to convince someone that the illusion is real. I mean, so
you basically have to blank everything out but the specific thing that you can try to hold on to and then not deal with anything else at all.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, wow, ultimately, only one being exists, and all plurality is an illusion. Man, I got to go out and proclaim this to the masses. It doesn't follow. Because, it's like, let me go visit the illusion to convince the illusion that the illusion, you know, it doesn't exist. Having said that, when I'm not talking here at this point how to lead a pantheist to Christ, okay, because pantheists are human beings, and because they have to think in rational categories, this is stuff you may want to share with them. But what I'm not saying is that you're going to have like an 87.5% success rate with them, because you won't. Sometimes the more contradictions you point out about a pantheist, the happier they get, because they reject the law of non-contradiction. So they pride themselves in contradictions. But I think ultimately behind that facade is a human being who shouldn't be able to sleep well at night with contradictions. So hopefully we can get through, but you know, we're getting very close to what C.S. Lewis called, where, you know, men without chests, men without consciences, where the abolition of man, where human beings are walking around, but they're non-man. And now I think he was overstating his case just to bring a point home, because literally man can't become non-man, but we're coming very close to human beings who are rejecting everything that separates human beings from the animal kingdom. And so, you know, it's really scary to say the least. Another point here, too, is that reincarnation offers no reason to be moral or charitable. We talked about this earlier, that if someone is suffering, in the Christian worldview, you can help alleviate their suffering. In the pantheist worldview, with reincarnation, it actually is even worse than not mattering. You're actually...
the karma.
Yeah, you're messing with the guy's karma. The guy's suffering, working off some of his negative karma so he'll get a better reincarnation. You know, better incarnation guaranteed in the next life. And by you alleviating some of his suffering, now he's got to be... takes out that suffering with him. So you're actually holding back his escape from the cycle of reincarnation. You're holding back his attainment of nirvana. So reincarnation actually discourages people from helping. That's why Mother Teresa had such a monopoly out there in India. You know, because if it wasn't for Christians didn't go there and build the hospitals, there just wouldn't be any hospitals. I mean, you might have a few nominal Hindus, just as we have nominal Christians, people go to Christian church but don't really believe anymore. You might have a few nominal Hindus who are really secular humanists who for some inconsistent reason want to help their fellow man, so they build a hospital, but for the most part, you know, you take out the Christian missionary hospital movement in India, and India would have very few hospitals. Pantheism teaches that God is unknowable because he's beyond rational categories, again, because there's no duality, no plurality. So God is unknowable.
Isn't that contradictory to them too? Since God is everything, then we know some things about everything, trees, earth, and all that, so we can know some things about God.
But even there, I would agree that it is contradictory there. But even there, though, they would say, well, we really don't know things about God because all things are part of the illusion. Because ultimately, there's only one thing. And so you end up having a God. It's real weird because you end up saying, well, then I am God. But then God is this unknowable God. So, I mean, you can't even know yourself. So if God is unknowable, how can we know that pantheism is true?
And if all things are illusion and God's everything, and even illusion is what?
Well, they would argue that Brahman is the ultimately real, but all we can see is just these illusions. And the thing is, too, is they would argue you can't know God, but you can feel him, intuit him. That's why, rather than study of scriptures and heavy theology, they would focus on meditation, a cessation of thought, so that you can be one with God in mystical union, but there's nothing intellectual involved there. I'll tell you, Karl Barth, the neo-Orthodox theologian, said almost the same thing. That we, during a moment of crisis, we encounter God and His Word, but it's an encounter that we can't put into words. And so, secular existentialism, religious existentialism, they both have a lot in common with mystical, the mystical experiences of Eastern meditation. But another point against pantheism: if the world is an illusion, how can we be sure of anything? I mean, if the ground we're standing on, if we're going to question the existence of the ground we're standing on, or the existence of the chairs we're sitting on, or the existence of the table we're leaning on, if we're going to question stuff that is that obvious, okay, how can we be sure of anything? Especially, I mean, if pantheism is basically saying, look, I know the truth, and the truth is this: everything that seems obviously true to you is false, and the one thing that seems so weird and so unbelievable and so unprovable, that's the one thing that's true. And so it's almost like the basic argument for pantheism is, hey, accept my view because there's no evidence for it. Because everything that we see that is out there is an illusion. So any evidence that you can compile is an illusion. So accept my view, which by definition you can't present evidence for it.
Yeah, delusional.
Yeah. Yeah, so the fifth point there, can we really live like evil is an illusion? If you took a Buddhist monk and picked them up and put them on your shoulders and threw them and onto the ground and then picked them up and slapped them around, and if the guy's going to just act like it's not really happening and then it's not really evil, I think the guy ought to get a life and acknowledge that what's being done to him is evil, and either fight back or call the cops or something. But now panentheism is very close. It's also called process theism. It's very close to pantheism, but there is a difference. Rather than God being the universe is God's body. So it's like God is like the soul of the world. He's not identified with the world, but he has such a close relationship to the world. It's like the relationship of a soul to a human soul to a human body. But in panentheism, they actually argue that God has an infinite pole and a finite pole. Basically, an infinite aspect to himself and a finite aspect to himself. Okay? So that in God's basic nature, he is both finite and infinite, both limited and unlimited. But that's a contradiction. God cannot be both finite and infinite in his basic nature. Because to be finite means you have limitations. To be infinite means you have no limitations. So you can't have it both ways. It's either or. Now, having said that, if that is the case, and I think it very clearly is the case, how do we explain the incarnation of Christ?
Both infinite and finite at the same time.
And so are we saying that Jesus is infinite and finite in his basic nature?
No, because he was always God.
So always God, so he always had an infinite nature.
But it was just in his humanity that it was limited.
Right. See, basically it's what theologians call the hypostatic union. Jesus always existed as God, the infinite God, the second person of the Trinity. But at a point in time, he added a human nature, a limited human nature. So Jesus exists eternally. Ever since he became a man, he exists eternally as one person with two natures, a limited nature and an unlimited nature. Okay? That's not what these guys are saying. These guys are not saying that God was infinite and then he added a finite nature. These guys are saying that God in his basic nature is both infinite and finite. Okay? The difference would be the Christian theist, we're driving a truck that's got two tanks, two gas tanks. It's possible for one to be empty and the other to be full. And that's not a contradiction. But the process theologians, the panentheists, are driving a truck with one tank, and they're saying at the same time it's both empty and full at the same time in the same way. And then that's a contradiction.
Well, could they be saying that since the God is soul of the universe, his soul, like the universe, could be eternal, but things are finite, like trees die, people die, and those things are finite of God. But
By saying that the universe is God's body is kind of a layman's way of defining it, because basically it's. It's to the point, very close to pantheism, but it's to the point. In fact, Matthew Fox is a panentheist. But New Age pantheists love him. But it's so confusing that I thought that they would argue that God's actual pole is infinite and eternal, and his potential pole is finite and limited and temporal. But they argue the exact opposite. They argue that God's actual pole, his actual aspect, is finite, temporal, and his potential pole is infinite and eternal. In other words, it's like Norman Geisler argued, and he comes from a Thomistic school of thought that really has got down pat the distinction between the actual realm and the potential realm. Geisler argues in process theism it's contradictory at its core because it has the absurd idea that a potentiality actualizes itself, whereas potentialities do not actualize themselves. And potentialities, the potential to do or to be something, do not exist except in something actual.
Like Adam and Eve had the potential to then they actualized
it. Yeah, and they actualized it. But if all you had was a potential, okay. Lenny Stinkle, 5'10", 175 pounds. Blonde hair, blue eyes, big nose. Okay, I just made him up. He doesn't really exist, but it's a potential person. You know, it's a possible, a hypothetical person, possible person. So because he's only potential, he can't actualize anything, can't do anything. Now, God had the idea of Phil Fernandez. When he actualized Phil Fernandez, the actual God actualized Phil Fernandez, then Phil Fernandez could actualize some of those potentials that he had. But when there is no Phil Fernandez, and Phil Fernandez is just a potential, just a possible being, but it has no actual existence, it can't actualize anything. These guys have potential existence actualizing actual existence. They've got it all backwards. It's like a cup of coffee has the potential to be filled, but it doesn't have the potential to fill itself. And you know, these guys have got it all twisted around. And it's a real... It deals with Hegelian philosophy. it brings in the idea that they try to drag God down to man's level. Basically, they're looking for a changing God, and they're acting like if God doesn't change, he can't really relate to human beings. And so they end up really trying to get God... they drag God down to our level, but as point two says, a finite, changing God would need an infinite, non-changing God to ground its existence. The only way for the panentheistic God to exist would be if the theistic God existed and created it.
Well, isn't there a truth in that statement that God did have to change? I mean, that's what the person of Jesus Christ was. He became human, understood our suffering, etc., and also to die on Calvary.
Even there, though, there wouldn't be a basic change in God, the second person of the Trinity's nature.
Right, because he was still God.
It would just be adding a new no. nature. And basically, if I understand correctly, most theologians, when they talk about God being unchanging, most traditional theologians, they're talking about God being unchanging in his basic nature, in his essence. And these guys are basically saying that God is changing in his infinite. In fact, these guys are... The basic debate among the ancient Greek philosophers was, what is reality being, that which is, or is reality becoming? And the philosophers who won the day were not the Heraclitus guys, and who were focusing on change and all, and not even the Parmenides philosophers were focusing on reality just being one unchanging being. But the guys who won the day were like Plato and Aristotle, who combined being and becoming, and said that being, that which is, the actual realm, different things that actually exist have different potentialities. And so basically, as I change, as I get older, there is that aspect of being, that human being called Phil Fernandez, that remains the same, but has these changes. Otherwise, they wouldn't be changes in this being. It would be different beings, you know, just little. But some philosophers have argued, are we beings that experience change? Or, you know, is there an I, an ego? Is there an unchanging self that experiences these changes? Or are we just a collection of changes? And David Hume showed, as an empiricist, he was a skeptic, that just from data from the five senses, if that's all we have, you can never find the enduring I. That basically all we are is our experiences. We're not... I'm not a person who has these experiences and stuff. Well, the process theologians are saying that we sided with the wrong Greek philosophers. We should have sided with the Greek philosophers who believed ultimate reality is change. And so they see this changing God as the ultimate. Deism... Theism is the idea that God created the universe but doesn't intervene. He doesn't perform miracles. He kind of created the universe and then just left it alone. Set the laws of motion, the laws of nature in motion, and just left things as they were. First point there is that creation is God's greatest miracle. So if God could do the greatest miracle, create the whole universe out of nothing, then what's stopping him from being able to perform lesser miracles? He could create the entire universe out of nothing, then who says he can't give a lame person the ability to walk? He's the one who made legs in the first place. It also seems that if God freely chose to create the universe out of nothing, then it seems that he would also be willing to intervene, to get his point across, to communicate. with us. And we already said to show that the laws of nature are not prescriptive. They don't prescribe the way things have to be. Instead, they describe the way things normally occur. So, you know, God's the one who made the laws of nature. He can supersede them any time that he chooses. His hands are not tied. If he wants to, you know, I believe, by the way, both the laws of nature, the order we find in nature, is evidence of God as a designer. But when God intervenes and interrupts and supersedes the laws of nature and performs a miracle, then that's also an even bigger attention grabber. So I think in a...